We will call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming, and we will get into this relatively quickly. Mr. Tilson is going to come up after we hear from Anita Newman, and Mr. Tilson has to go to another meeting, so we will let him testify first and then ask him hopefully short to the point questions, and we can let him get on his way to his next meeting. With that, Ms. Newman, if you want to go ahead and brief us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I just have a brief comment that could I make?
Sure.
Many of us went down to Rochester and we had a meeting. I didn't run this by my side of the aisle or yours. I'm sorry for that, but I just feel compelled to say something. When we were down in Rochester, as is tradition and as members, we're given stuff by our staff, and I was very disappointed that that our briefs became an item of in the news. And I think it's just really bad for the body, because often, you know, committees aren't divided. I mean, we're very friendly on this committee, but often on other committees I serve on, I'll sit right next to a Republican member, and they'll have a bill brief done by their staff, and I'll have one, you know, done by mine. We'll kind of joke about things, and, you know, our side saying this, yours is that. But I was disappointed that it was, I'm guessing, taken or something. I don't really want to, I'm not sure what happened. I guess I just want to express my disappointment that our partisan staff information meant for us was brought public, as I would be disappointed if yours was made public. I just think that it's bad for the institution on either side of the aisle, and I would defend your side to the same level if our side did the same, you know, if it became public. So I just want to express my disappointment. I don't say that as a DFLer. I just say that as a institutional member. So thank you for this time.
Well, you're welcome, Representative Lilly, and I think I agree and echo your comments. I think in the past, all of us on both sides of the aisle have had information like that, and you either just disregard it or leave it there or dispose of it properly. So I think it's a word to the wise of all of us. I think that was well said. Thank you for that. With that, we will go to Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm going to give you a very, very brief overview of the two primary labor laws that affect the issue that you're discussing today. The first is Chapter 179, which is the Minnesota Labor Relations Act. The employers that law covers are all employers with the following exceptions: the state, all of its political subdivisions, or any person subject to the Railway Labor Act. As employees, that law excludes agricultural laborers, those employed by a parent or spouse, or those employed in the domestic service of a person in a person's home. The key elements of the Minnesota Labor Relations Act are it provides that employees have the right to self-organize, to form, join, and assist labor organizations to bargain collectively, and it also provides the right to refrain from those activities. On the employer side, it provides that employers have the right to associate together for the purpose of collective bargaining. Chapter 179 establishes the Bureau of Mediation Services, and the commissioner who is here, I'm going to let him go through the rights and responsibilities and the duties of that agency. The law provides for exclusive representatives for the purpose of collective bargaining. It sets forth the meaning of exclusive. It provides for a certification process by the Bureau of Mediation Services, which includes investigation, hearings, and secret ballot votes. It sets parameters for agreements, collective bargaining agreements, including notice requirements, timelines, and procedures for methods for dispute resolution. And it provides for the operations and elections of labor organizations. It also outlines unfair labor practices by both employers and employees. It specifically prohibits secondary boycotts and it prohibits coercion. Now, and it also does some other things that aren't particularly relevant to this discussion, but it's the Packing House Workers Bill of Rights, and it also has a labor management committee and grant program. Now, the second major law is PELRA, which is Chapter 179A. That's the Public Employment Labor Relations Act. That law has some very specific definitions. It defines public employee as any person appointed or employed by a public employer with the following exclusions: public officials, election officers, certain part-time or temporary workers, certain emergency workers, persons working for the Minnesota State College and University System under professional or technical contracts, employees of charitable hospitals, full-time undergraduate students who are employed under a work study or a similar arrangement, some adult vocational education instructors, certain court employees, and there's a specific provision which fences out legislative employees for coverage under PELRA. PELRA defines a public employer as the state of Minnesota or its political subdivisions, the Board of Regents of the U of M, the state court administrator, the State Board of Public Defense, the Hennepin Healthcare System, and local political subdivisions. PELRA also gives the BMS commissioner certain rights, responsibilities, and duties in certifying or decertifying exclusive representatives, collecting and retaining information, and conducting hearings and elections. It sets forth a number of specifics on the collective bargaining process related to public employees. And a very important one is it provides for specific bargaining units. It provides for procedures for exclusive representatives, provides for contracts, provides for grievance arbitration, provides for negotiation, mediation, and arbitration processes, and provides for fair share fees, meet and confer, and meet and negotiate. It authorizes strikes and sets forth the conditions under which those strikes can occur. It provides for unfair labor practices by public employees and public employers. And it sets out some other key definitions, including essential employee, exclusive representative, fair share fee challenge, meet and confer, meet and negotiate, and professional employee. And that is, I think, my almost under 2 minutes summary of those two laws.
Well, thank you, Ms. Newman. And members, we might have questions, but unless it's immediately pressing, if we could bring forward Mr. Tilson, who has got another time commitment. Ms. Newman is going to be here with us until 5 o'clock when we're done today. So we can, Mr. Tilson, if you'd like to come forward and identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Josh Tilson. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Bureau of Mediation Services. Thanks for the opportunity to appear today to address the questions you have concerning the Executive Order 1131 that the Governor signed on November 15, 2011, last Tuesday.
Mr. Chairman, if I might interrupt
Representative Atkins,
just briefly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and pardon me, Commissioner Tilson. Commissioner Tilson just referenced some questions that we have for him. Was there, Mr. Chair, all we got on our side was a three-line agenda.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did have written answers to those questions. Would you like me to pass them on now?
That would be great because we haven't seen the questions, have we? Mr. Chair, were there questions that were shared with the commissioner that we didn't see over on this side?
I apologize. I received some questions from the chair, is that correct? Or from the chair administrator, actually, committee administrator on Friday, I think, or Thursday, I don't remember, but okay. I prepared some written answers, which I was going to walk through those here.
Well, and actually, I guess, Mr. Chair, the question is for you. We don't know precisely why we're here. We've got a three-item agenda. If you could give us a little overview so we know what we're set to accomplish. We went down to Rochester. We heard from folks down there. They were very clear. Even the opponents said they didn't object to a union. They just wanted to make sure that it was voluntary. That's what the governor ordered. And now we're here under some threats of a lawsuit. I think Senator Hahn is already talking about a lawsuit. And now we find out that there's questions that have been given to the commissioner that we haven't had an opportunity to see. Could you just sort of give us an overview of what we're doing? I feel like Columbo, back in the
You got to get the raincoat.
Like I should scratch my head and have a rumpled raincoat on, but it's a little unclear what the purpose of the hearing is.
Well, Representative Atkins and members, I think when we were in Rochester, we had a lot of good testimony from people on both sides of the issue. But one of the things that we were, well, many of the things we were trying to find out were questions that the union, that we had of the union, and there were questions about the vote and how the vote would proceed and if there was going to be a vote, and once there was a vote, if there was one, how the union would look after that and fair share and all kinds of things. And justifiably, I think the union did not have a lot of answers to those questions, and many of the questions we had were answered with variations on, well, we'll have to wait and see the governor's executive order, and we'll have to wait and see how things come out. Well, now we have the governor's executive order, and we have an election coming up in a short time here, and I think we have a lot of the questions that this committee had in Rochester that now we should be able to get at least more clear or more concrete answers from both the unions and from Mr. Tilson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as a matter of courtesy, if there's questions like these, it would have helped if we saw these on Friday. I'm not pointing a finger. I'm just saying it would have been helpful, at least for our side. Perhaps your side prepared the questions and knows what's in the memo here. But it is helpful to see what the questions are that Commissioner Tilson is being asked to respond to. Thank you.
Representative Atkins, that's noted. I think that's fair. And I don't think that anybody on our side has seen the questions or the answers either. I could be wrong in that, but I don't think they have. I haven't. So.
Okay.
Thank you, and we are under a little bit of a time constraint with Mr. Tilson, so if you could go ahead and please proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a little bit of my thunder got stolen by your research analyst, so, but let me just...
She's very good at that.
Yeah.
It happens to us all the time.
But let me just say a little bit of what I was going to say before, which is that, as I think you probably were just told, that the Bureau, of which I'm the commissioner, is an agency of the state of Minnesota. Our mission is to promote stable and constructive labor management relations, and significantly in this context, the use of alternative dispute resolution processes in areas other than labor management. As was explained, under PELRA, the BMS is responsible to oversee collective bargaining throughout the public sector in Minnesota, including all the cities, counties, public school districts, the executive branch, the judicial branch, all of the public institutions of higher education, numerous special boards and commissions, and publicly operated hospitals, as well as our jurisdiction under PELRA, which was previously explained. The bulk of our work involves labor mediation. That's most of what we do, is settling labor disputes. We also do representation work, which was explained, which basically involves resolving questions of which unions represent which employees. We also administer the state's roster of neutral labor arbitrators who are independent contractors. So that's who I am, and that's what the Bureau of Mediation Services does. When the governor consulted me about the question of union representation for family child care providers, I recognized that what was proposed was not traditional labor management relations. It's not. These are independent, as has been reported in the press, and as I think everybody who examines the situation is aware, these are independent small businesses. They are not either contractors with the state, nor are they employees of the state. So it's not labor management relations. Nobody, if you ask the unions, they agree with that as well. I don't think there's any belief that they are. That said, I knew that BMS has the technical expertise and experience to oversee an election of the type that was proposed. And I concluded that this type of a non-labor management dispute does fall within the scope of our mission. It's unique for us and unusual, but it does fall within the scope of our mission. That was what I concluded after being, you know, questioned by the governor as to whether or not we could play a role in it. I learned that opponents, as Representative Atkins mentioned, had asked that there be an election conducted, and specifically in a meeting with the governor, asked that the election be overseen by BMS. I decided we could. And we should serve the role of neutral to ensure fairness and transparency if an election was to be conducted, and the governor asked us to do it. The executive order directs me, as the commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services, to conduct 2 mail ballot elections within 60 days after its issuance. The purpose of these elections is to determine whether Ask Me Council 5 and SEIU shall represent licensed, registered, subsidized family child care providers in one of 2 appropriate units as requested by these unions in a letter to the governor. I have, and I think that letter was made public when the governor released the executive order. If it's not, I know it's public, and I'm sure I didn't bring a copy with me, but I know it can be obtained from the governor's office. I have decided for practical reasons to obtain technical assistance from the American Arbitration Association, and I'll explain why in my answers to your questions. So with your permission, I'll just go ahead and walk through the questions that you posited, unless you want me to use some other procedure.
We can do that unless members have any other questions.
Let me just walk through these, okay. And I'll read these, and maybe you can just question me as we go along here. It might just trigger the questions you want to get answered. The first question that was sent to me, and by the way, I want to apologize. I should have probably emailed this to everybody this morning. I thought that you just wanted me to be here to answer these questions, so it didn't occur to me to email them, but I could easily have done that. How many licensed child care providers are eligible to vote in the election? Based on the criteria that we have, there are 4,287 that were on an initial list provided to BMS by DHS. This could change a little bit if errors are discovered. We've already discovered a couple duplicates on the list, and there are some names that appeared on the list we got from DHS which are not family child care providers but are institutional child care providers that would be covered under other labor laws, and I'm hoping that we can come up with an arrangement to purge those from the list because they're not. I don't think they were intended to be covered by the executive order. What's the criteria being used? Providers who were registered to accept child care assistance program payments as of October 15th and received at least one such payment in the preceding year. That's the criteria that was used to draw the list of eligible voters. And as I said, there's some data cleanup on the list that provided Representative
Mr. Tilson, we have our first questions for you.
Sure.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tilson, thanks for coming today to answer some questions. I'm just curious, you said that you're using this list of 4,287 provided by DHS.
Yes, ma'am.
What kind of verifications have been done on that list to make sure that these are truly people that are providing care at this time? Is it just for one child? Do we know, last week we saw a huge news article for Channel 5 talking about fraud within the system. I mean, has that been checked? I mean, the way I understand it, the counties haven't had a chance to kind of go through that fraudulent process. So, I mean, how do we really know that this is an accurate list that we're using?
We always have when we do an election. Let me just say that we do lots of elections every year, and correcting lists and ensuring accurate lists of eligible voters is something we do all the time. This is a very unusual circumstance, I dare say unique for us, so it's not like something we've done before. The list we have, we got from DHS based on the criteria that I've said here. That's what we asked for. They did a data run. That's how we got the list. Right now, we're going through a correction process where we're looking over the list. DHS is looking over the list, and I've asked some others to look over the list to see who's missing. And we would like any public comments. The list is publicly available as I comment below. But the question that you ask about why we used only providers who had let me put it differently. If they were registered to receive child care assistance programs, whether or not they had a child currently in their care, that was your question. We didn't think it was fair to just limit it to people who presently did. We understand from what we've been told, what I learned from the DHS commissioner, that people have kids coming in and out of their care on a regular basis. Being registered doesn't mean that you have a kid now, but you might next month, you might not have last month, you might not this month. And I basically made it as an administrative decision, and that administrative decision, ma'am?
Oh.
I'm sorry. I see you're holding
nope.
Your hand up.
Go ahead, Mr. Tilson. I think Representative Anderson has a follow-up question okay. when you're done.
But we concluded that we'd go back 1 year, and somebody had to have had a child in their care within 1 year of the date we pulled the list. We thought that was fair, and that's the criteria we used. Now, as far as further purifying the list is public, and we're going to listen to public comments on it, and we're going to try to make sure that we only have people who are registered and who have or have had such families or children in their care in the previous year.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, a couple of suggestions that I have. The other question that I had is, verifying that the addresses are actually good with the postal department. But I'm just curious, so it's fair to have the 4,287 potentially vote, but not all 11,000 providers?
Well, that was
vote?
One of the questions that was posed by the committee.
Because as I understand it, Mr. Tilson, we have 7,000 daycare providers now that have no opportunity to vote on this, yet they will be impacted on this vote. So 7,000 daycare providers, no say on this, but 4,200 who may or may not actually have children under their care. Is that correct?
Mr. Tilson.
The question, as it was posited to me, was why is the election limited to only those who take subsidies? That was the way the question was put to me. My answer, as I understood it, was that those are the providers who receive CCAP payments and have a direct financial connection to the state. I was also asked the question that if the union is formed, will the agreements reached between the union and the state apply to all of the 11,000 providers or just to those who receive state subsidies? And the answer is, I don't know. Okay, I frankly don't, but when I talked with the commissioner and talked with some others, you'll see here it's, what I wrote is that they need to be cautious about agreeing to things that affect providers who are not part of the meet and confer process. On further discussion, I think that it's up to the Department of Human Services, but I think that they will very unlikely to agree to changes that are going to affect people that don't have an input. The other thing about this is that one of the things that makes this very different from traditional labor relations is there's nothing exclusive about this. Others can approach the department with concerns on these issues and can ask to have input into these same items that the union is negotiating with, or actually not negotiating, they're meeting and conferring with the DHS about. So that's the answer I have for your question.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. A couple questions surrounding the signatures. So it's my understanding that in order to have an election, you need 30% of a unit of some sort to sign a petition, to sign a card, put their signature down. Is that list, that 30%, is that limited to the 4,287 number that was provided to BMS by DHS?
BMS, this is not under PELRA. That 30% requirement is a PELRA requirement. This is not an election under PELRA. The governor has ordered me or directed me to do an election. I haven't examined any cards. There was a letter to the governor from the unions on November 8th asking for an election. There had been an ongoing public controversy about this, and the governor ordered an election. The unions, as I understood it from what the governor said at his press conference, were asking him to certify these unions based simply upon cards. And the governor declined to do that and instead directed me to do an election. So I haven't looked at the cards. I don't know. The answer to your question is I don't know.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Commissioner, in other words, this executive order and the election that you're about to oversee is not being asked by the employees or by the employers. I know that you've said this is non-traditional, but who's asking to be unionized here then if you're saying that you've not received cards or verified cards, which from what I understand, under every other scenario, you've got to have a group of a unit that would want to be unionized. So who is that group here, and how are they saying we would like to go through this next step?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Tilson.
The answer to your question is that this was an executive decision, that there was a ongoing public controversy that needed to be resolved. It is not under traditional labor relations processes. The Bureau's authority here rises in two ways, as I understand it, primarily because there was an executive order and it was directed by the Bureau. We're analogizing it to the processes used under labor relations because that's the one that seems most familiar to everybody. But it's not, let me put it this way, we are not following, there isn't a procedure that's being used that's identical to the ones that are normally used when a petition is filed. Also, under the Minnesota Labor Relations Act, there is no requirement for 30% filing. A union can, and this is also true in certain circumstances under the National Labor Relations Act, an employer can ask to raise a question of whether or not a union is properly certified without any card. And also under the National Labor Relations Act, under the Minnesota Labor Relations Act, either a union or an employer can ask to have a question raised without cards, although typically we require cards, but there's no requirement that we do. In this case, I was directed to do an election by the governor, and that's what we're doing.
So, Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, so then just to be clear, so again, as far as BMS is concerned, you do not have a group of individuals, a group of employers asking for this in any way. This is purely based on the executive order from the governor, an executive decision, which is why you are saying there is no process and that this is non-traditional. Is that correct?
Well, I think if I said there is no process, I may have misspoken myself. The process we're using are the similar processes to certainly ensuring the integrity of the election that we would use under a labor relations election. specifically with respect to the question of what's known in labor relations as a showing of interest, there isn't a requirement for one in this situation, and none has been demanded. There was a claim, what's known in labor relations as a claim of majority status. The unions claim it to be the majority representative. That's a pretty much a term of art in labor relations. And having made such a claim, the governor has determined that the way to resolve it is to have an election.
Representative Sanders, you got to
remain. I guess just one follow-up question, Mr. Chair. Outside of the executive order, could you, and this fitting within the scope of your mission, could you give an answer as to why this election wouldn't be done under the NLRB as opposed to BMS? You know, in a sense, why did the governor choose BMS over a more traditional election style of the NLRB?
Commissioner Tilson.
I don't know the exact answer to that. I do know that, as I said, when meeting with opponents, they specifically asked to have the BMS supervise it. And I'll be, you know, to be very frank, I know that in many other states the AAA did this, where they do have agencies analogous to us. In many other states, the AAA did do it. And they asked to have us do it, so the governor asked me to oversee it. Later on, I'll talk about the fact that we're engaging the services of AAA for a lot of the technical services on this. But that's why, as I understand it.
Thank you. Representative thank you. Anderson.
Yes, thank you. I have a couple questions. Who is the one that's making the decisions then of what the procedure is that you're going to be following for this election? Who's making that decision?
Commissioner Tilson.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Oh. Representative Anderson, I am.
And so the procedures that you're going to be following, you're not going to be basing them on the normal procedures?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, as much as I can. I am trying to follow the normal procedures as much as possible. All right. There are some things about this that are just not directly, just do not translate, because as I said earlier, it's not employer-employee relations, and there are certain aspects that are not the same.
So Representative Anderson.
My question is, what basis are you determining that only the 42 get to vote instead of all of the daycare providers? What is the reasoning behind why can't all of them vote?
Well, first of all, the governor said at his press conference in response to that question is that it was his feeling that there was a closer nexus, a closer direct tie to the department and its requirements for CCAP providers because they get direct subsidy payments from the state. But really, the answer is because that's what the executive order directs.
You good, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tilson, Commissioner Tilson, you talked about how you decided you picked 1 year time period to go back. How is this different than, say, XYZ contracting or XYZ manufacturing? How do you go determine in a normal election how far you go back to who's going to be included in and who's going to be excluded out? Because in an earlier question, they talked about, well, there's 7,000 daycare workers, and you're choosing the ones that only get the CCAP money. You're going back a year. How is that different than how you would determine who's eligible to vote and who's not eligible? Because, I mean, you could say for XYZ manufacturing, well, 20 years from now, I may be working for them. I should be able to vote now. Or 10 years ago, I worked for them. I mean, how do you determine that in a normal election?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, you've highlighted a problem that we have in trying to figure this out. Normally, in a union election, the people who are employed then are the ones who vote. And people who may vote, who quit last week or actually quit during the pendency of the election, if people quit after we mail out the ballots, their votes don't get tabulated in a normal union election. And if people get hired the day after the election, they don't vote either. That's normal. In this context, I decided, actually, that I thought that we should broaden it out. There was some criticism from some people for our decision to broaden it out beyond that. But I felt that the folks who have registered, who are registered to receive subsidies, and who have at least had some child should be allowed to vote because it was very likely that they would in the future. The list would have been much smaller. Originally, we thought about the idea of, okay, we'll take the month of October, the month of September, and just let folks who had a child in their care during that month vote. But that would have narrowed the list down to less than 3,000. And I just didn't think that was appropriate. I thought that if a provider was actively engaged in this, and it made more sense and it was fair. That's
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Tilson, we're looking at having a vote where there's 11,000 people that can be affected. 4,287 have the chance to vote. And I think I was somewhat troubled when Representative Anderson asked her question as to what your answer was and what it is in writing here. The question is, we have the difference with what Representative Nelson said. He said, well, somebody in the future, well, these are 11,000 people that are providing daycare right now or have recently. So the question was, you're going to have a few people voting on an issue that's going to affect everybody, all 11,000. And the question was asked, what happens there? And you said you didn't know. And I appreciate that. I think that's a very honest answer. You don't know. So we're going to be going into an election where probably the biggest question there is, we don't know what the answer is. Well, that's troubling to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me just say that I did talk with the Commissioner of Human Services and the Governor's Office before I testified today about this question because, frankly, I didn't like my answer to that question. I didn't really know what the answer was, and I talked to them about it because I really wasn't sure. And I'm informed that it's not intended that items that they will agree upon that will affect all licensed, but they're going to focus on discussions on meeting and conferring and discussions on items that are specifically directed at providers who are on the CCAP program. That's my understanding. And so, but I mean, when I said I don't know, this is one of those things where, again, I say this is a unique situation, so.
And Mr. Tilson, I can jump in on Representative Davids, you said you were informed. Who informed you of that?
Well, I actually talked with some of the members of the governor's staff, and I talked also with the Department of Human Services staff.
Okay.
And the Commissioner of Human Services.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
and Representative Davids,
it seems to me that there's no safeguard here because 4,200 vote, it very likely could affect all 11,000, whether it be fair share, which I don't see any safeguards where fair share is going to be, doesn't apply to the full 11,000. Who would know the answer to the question on how the 11,000 are affected by a vote of only 4,200?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, who would know? Is the people who will meet and confer. And with respect to the question or the comment about fair share or any involuntary payments of any kind are specifically prohibited by the executive order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody else? Any further questions before we let Commissioner Tilson proceed? Please go ahead. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, right. I thought he was. Yeah, I thought you were going to go through the rest of your
minute. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, fine. I didn't want. I thought you guys just rung me out.
Oh, no. You don't get out of here that easily.
Okay. We covered a lot of these questions. So why is the one of the questions that we discussed this whole question about why the grouping was determined and what the bargaining will be. Why the election is going to be determined by 50% plus one of the votes cast and not a majority of eligible voters was that this is the way we always conduct elections, frankly. The BMS and the NLRB conduct certification and decertification elections regularly. Only those who cast ballots have their ballots counted, and the winner must receive 50% plus one of the votes tabulated. I know that some people say that a failure to vote is a yes vote, but that's not any true than to say the reverse. The correct way to describe the system is to say that only people whose votes count are those who cast a ballot. In elections for public office, candidates often win with fewer than 50% of the votes cast, and they almost always win with 50% of the eligible voters. A union cannot be certified without achieving more than half of the votes that are cast. So, basically, that's the procedure that's almost always used in these kinds of elections. What's the wording on the ballot? It's here. I mean, as I said, there's two simultaneous mail ballot elections with 37 counties on the NCIA group and 50 counties in the AFSCME group. There's the wording on the ballot is, and by the way, we're going to print the ballot, and there apparently are a number of different languages the ballot's going to be printed in, because I've been informed that there are some family providers in certain of these geographical areas that are, for example, primarily Somali, primarily Hmong, or primarily Hispanic, Spanish speakers. And so the ballots are going to be printed in several languages. But the ballots will be worded as it says here: do you wish to be represented by, you know, SEIU or AFSCME for the purpose of meet and confer with the state of Minnesota regarding issues of mutual concern? That's the wording on the ballot. When will we mail them? I did announce December 6th at the press conference, but after recounting looking at the calendar, I think December 7th is the soonest we can mail the ballots, with a return deadline of December 21st. Barring any unforeseen problems, we'll tabulate the ballots on December 22nd. The question, will the ballots be mailed only once? As with pretty much any other election, if an eligible voter does not receive a ballot, they can call a publicly available toll-free number to request a second ballot. Security measures will be in place to ensure that no person casts more than one ballot. And I can answer any questions you might have about that.
Well, we have a number of questions. Do you want to, maybe we'll take questions and we'll, you won't need to go through everything. We'll get this answered. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions. What was the logic or thought process of not spelling out SEIU and AFSCME? Because I think there's a lot of citizens that maybe don't know what that stands for.
Commissioner Tilson.
First of all, this is what we usually do, but also these were the names that were put forward in the letter, the claiming representation that was sent to us by the two unions that petitioned.
Okay.
These were the names that they put on their letter requesting.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not everybody, here around the Capitol, we know what SEIU stands for and AFSCME stands for and everything, but I think an average Jewish citizen maybe who hasn't been familiar with the union process maybe doesn't know what those stand for. I think that would be helpful in your wording to put that change in there. But then also the other question that I had is dealing with the mailing of the ballots. Now, you have here a return deadline of December 21st of 2011. Is that postmarked or received by that date?
It's received by.
Okay, Mr. Chair. And then, Mr. Tilson, you said that they're going to be mailed on December 7th. Have you checked to see, what is the standard delivery rate? I mean, you go into some greater Minnesota areas, it might be a five-day delivery time, once it travels through the Minneapolis and then it goes out. I mean, and sometimes even longer, depending upon what other demands there are. Given that it's Christmas season, you're going to have Christmas packages being delivered, you have Christmas cards. There tends to be more of a delay when it comes to delivery of things, just given the volume that is happening through the post office. Have you given any consideration to that at all?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, we do these elections on a regular basis, monthly, and it's often weekly. 2 weeks is the standard, both for a statewide and a local election. We've been doing it for a long time. Over the years, we've run into a few problems here and there, but we've done elections of this size fairly frequently. Every 5 years, we'll have a big election with more than, a couple of thousand people. Usually, most of the elections we do have something between 40 and 200 people, but we've done elections of this size for the University of Minnesota and for the state of Minnesota, and with bigger than this. In the last 10 years, and this kind of a mailing schedule is not unheard of. I hear your concerns, and I'll take them into consideration. Thank you.
Are you good, Representative?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tilson, I'm really concerned, given the time frame that this is over the Christmas holiday season, the fact that you're doing this statewide. Now, a University of Minnesota vote, typically those are people that are going to be focused either at the metro area, in Duluth, in the Rochester area, some of the major hubs, whereas this is going statewide to everywhere from Halleck to Laverne. And I'm just a little concerned that a two-week time window is very short, not only just to receive the ballot, but then for these citizens then to turn around and get it back into the mail to you by the 21st. And I'm just wondering if you've taken into consideration the postmark part of it. And I'm really concerned that citizens won't really truly have a chance to have their vote count.
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, thank you. I have taken into consideration, and as I say, I'll consider what you've said. This is their normal procedure. and it's been successful for many, many years. So I'll consider what you've said.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tilson. I was reading through your questions that you submitted, and so some of them that I have are answered in that, but just looking at the tabulation of the ballots, I see they are going to be available for the public to observe that process, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they are.
Okay. And
excuse me, if I may.
Yes.
I mean, we do a lot of elections, big and small, and we have to do a little crowd control sometimes. Typically, what I'll do, or what the agency does, is we'll designate maybe a couple of observers from each side that can be up close to the ballots and watch, and then we'll typically have others that can be in the room but not standing close to the people who are counting because it gets crowd control become a problem. But yes,
okay. Representative Loon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So for those people that would be allowed kind of up close, how I assume that the unions will designate who they would like to watch, and for people who are perhaps opposed to this, how will they be able to have their designated representatives?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess the answer to your question is that there have been several public groups that have opposed unionization, and I'm sure that we can select representatives from those groups that can be present to observe.
Thank you.
Representative
and thank you, Mr. Chair. And just with regards to, I assume they're going to be hand-counted. There's a process for, I mean, you're talking, what, 42 plus 100 ballots, so they will be hand-counted, or is there a machine mechanism? How are they actually counted?
Chairman and Representative, I guess the answer is yes. That's what we always do, is counted by hand.
Okay. And if, Mr. Chair, if I may continue,
certainly.
If there's any dispute on a ballot, I see you've got kind of a yes or no. If somebody checks one, scribbles it out, checks another, there may be a question about it. What is your process for dealing with a perhaps disputed ballot?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dowdy, the answer to your question is that we do this all the time, and we rely on being able to, if we can't tell the intent of the voter, we don't count the ballot. If we can tell the intent, we do count the vote.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the intent is not clear, that ballot is not counted in the process.
That's
okay.
Fair.
And one final question, this is off the whole balloting process, but in listening to your testimony and Ms. Newman's presentation, I just had a question. Are there other examples of representation that is meet and confer representation in Minnesota, and another example of voluntary dues payments for union representation in Minnesota?
Commissioner Tilson,
you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dowdy. Those are two separate questions. Meet and confer occurs between unrepresented employees and employers, I think, on a regular basis in higher education and in K-12, where there's no certified unions in certain groups. They still meet to confer, and they even sometimes meet and negotiate. I think that there are independent unions that have voluntary dues all over the place. It's pretty common. There are a lot of organized groups that are certified by the Bureau where they don't have mandatory dues checkoff. That's a fairly common feature of independent unions. There's a lot of independent unions of school administrators, some school service employees, small groups of school support staff that are not affiliated with the union and either don't collect dues or just do so voluntarily. That's fairly common. And I'm sorry, your second question was?
Well, I think you kind of covered both of them. I was wondering about instances of that. If it's fairly common, if you could cite any specific examples.
Well, I think I've told you that, what I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Tilson. This has actually been very helpful. I think your answers to several of the questions in here brought some clarity to the issue of something of an unique situation and at risk. I was somewhat leery about even talking because I suspect that everything you say and everything I say is going to be in somebody's legal brief relatively shortly. Senator Hand seems to threaten a lawsuit on a daily basis, which I applaud, I might add. I'm a practicing lawyer, so the more lawsuits that Senator Hand wants to pursue, I guess the better.
Chairman, Representative Eck, it's easy for you to say.
Yeah, I'm not the receiver of the lawsuit. But the issue that... Well, two issues. First off, relative to the testimony that we've heard in Rochester and all of the comments that I've gotten from daycare providers. I applaud your efforts to follow this course and the governor's efforts to follow this course because it fully comports with what we heard in the testimony, even from the opponents. And apparently they talked directly with the governor about the fact that they don't object to a union. They just want to make sure that it's a voluntary choice, which the executive order covers, and then to put you folks in charge of the handling the election. I don't know who better in Minnesota we could look to handle an election than you and the folks at AAA, which for people around, it's not the American Automobile Association, which is a very venerable organization as well, but the American Arbitration Association, which has a terrific reputation for such things. The singular issue, though, that seems to come up again and again, and the one that requires some clarification, I hope, before the election occurs, is the one that's already been alluded to, and that's that 4,287 providers could potentially be making a decision that will apply to over 11,000. That is not how we try to handle our elections around here. And it's a very fair concern to have. And the fact that even you commented in your written remarks and your oral comments here that you didn't know whether or not that would be the case, I think that causes a great deal of concern for members on both sides of the aisle and anybody that cares about this issue. That is the single issue that hopefully can be clarified. And I would suggest that before the election occur, that issue be clarified, if for no other reason than just for fear of the that issue being the single issue that a court may focus on in the midst of a lawsuit. But just from a common sense standpoint, and in terms of how we handle elections, if you're going to be impacted, you ought to have a voice. If you're not, then those 4,287 can make the decision. But to go into the election without clarifying that first, I don't think is fair to those 11,000 that might be impacted.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Tilson.
Atkins, I you're right. I'll chat some more with the Commissioner of DHS and see if we can get that publicly clarified by them in terms of what the intent would be if they do meet and confer with the unions if there is a certification. I when I talked to the governor's office about this right before I came down here to testify, they told me that they understand that the intention of the governor was that the things that would be agreed upon they might discuss things that would affect everyone, but that specific agreements that were in any way affecting others would have to be not only involved in the merit and confer process, would have to be involved in discussions with other providers and probably with the legislature.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, just
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Tilson, exactly. Everything else that I have heard raised as far as a concern, the postage, the way that the ballots are going to be counted, I fully expect that that's going to occur in an appropriate fashion, and I have every confidence in your office and in the American Arbitration Association to carry that out. The only concern that I've heard of a substantive nature has been that 4,287 providers may be making a decision for all 11,000. So my hope would be that that particular point, unless there's other substantive concerns that get raised, if that one is addressed, I would hope that that would give folks the sort of confidence that they need to know that this election is an appropriate election and carries out exactly what those daycare providers that have been showing up for hearings comports exactly with what they've requested of us, is to let them make their choice, let it be voluntary. If there needs to be a union, that's fine, as long as they get to have a choice in an appropriate way. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. And members, do we have any other questions for Commissioner Tilson? Otherwise, he does need to leave, and we've kept him just about an hour. Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. I just had a question of the 4,200, or maybe if that's going to – there are different kinds of daycare providers. There's sole proprietors. There might be, you know, a one-woman shop, one-man shop. They might be an LLC or an S corporation, or they might be a church provider. Mm-hmm. Who gets to vote in those instances? And if you could clarify, if I have an S corporation and I have one or two, you know, daycare providers, you know, working for me, by what criteria? Who gets to vote? Is it the owner, or is it?
Well, I've been concerned about. I've been thinking about this, looking at the list. Mr. Chair,
Commissioner
Representative,
Tilson.
I've been thinking about this, looking at the list. As I said, there are some church-based and some school-based few that got on the list, and it was my understanding that the executive order did not was intended for in-home family, home-based family child care providers. My understanding that was the intention, and so that's the target group. Beyond that, I can't clarify beyond that except to say that the DHS drew a list that they understood was that group, and that's the list I have. It has some what I think are errors on it, and I'd like to get those, try to get those corrected. But beyond that, we're going to, that's the group that's targeted, the, using the criteria of family-based, so that we're not going to use institutions. Institutions are not going to vote.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up. So institutions, but if I have, if I have an LLC or an S corporation and I have one employee, who is that, one vote or is that two votes, or does the employee vote to unionize against my corporation?
It
or
was
how does that
one
work?
It is one vote per licensee. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Tilson.
Representative, that's the intent of the list, and that's one of the reasons why the list needs some clarification. For example, we have there are a couple of instances, or maybe more than a couple instances on the list where the same address has a couple of names there. And they only have one license, so why they have a couple of names, I'm not clear. Perhaps they license it together, a husband and wife, or you know, a couple of people license it together. But it's our intention that these are businesses that are voting. They're not employees that are voting. And so their employees aren't voting because it's not an election to determine whether the employees want to be represented. It's an election to determine whether or not the licensees want to join a group that's going to meet and confer with the Department of Human Services.
Thank you, Commissioner Tilson. We want to be respectful of your time. We do have a few more people that have questions. And I'll just let everybody know, as soon as Commissioner Tilson is done, we're going to try to get, hopefully, both SEIU and AskMe representatives up here to answer a couple of questions. With that, I think Representative Kiefer was next.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Just a couple questions. I think I read somewhere that the whole election process, ballots, everything is going to be paid for by the unions. Could you correct me on that?
Commissioner Tilson,
Representative, that's correct.
Okay. Will there be return postage on the ballots? To encourage people to...
Representative, yes.
Okay, thank you. A common complaint that I've heard is that there wasn't real clear reason why people originally, when they were solicited at the door, why they were signing yes on a card. And in fact, one lady confirmed with me that she asked for it back, and to Governor Dayton's office's kudos, they did return it back to her. Just wondering, back to language on the actual ballot, will there be some type of disclaimer explaining who is paying for this election, so it's not at taxpayers' expenses, and will it also explain that by voting yes, they are agreeing to potential union dues that they'll be obligated to pay for?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, we will, I think, disclose that the fact that they're paying for it. The second point is, as I said earlier, the executive order specifically prohibits that. And I don't know. I am not an attorney, and I'm definitely not a legislator, but I don't think that they can collect involuntary dues without getting a law passed.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank
Representative
you.
Kiefer, thank you. Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I apologize if I'm sitting with my back to you here. I was a little confused by your answer about the number, and I guess what I'm looking for is clarification. You had said that in conducting an election, you looked at maybe only using 1 month worth of if a provider had that child that received that state subsidy only for 1 month, that the number of people who qualified then might be too low, and I think the word you used was maybe inappropriate. The implication was that having more people involved in the election was better. Can you clarify for me why, you know, 4,287 then is good, and if more people are better, why aren't we using 11,000? It seems to me a little contradictory.
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I go back to what Representative Atkins said. We're trying to target the people who will be affected by this. And it was, when I looked at the executive order, I understood that the people who were to be affected by the meet and confer were the people who
receive subsidies and are in-home family-based, home-based family child care providers. That was kind of my understanding of what the intention was here. And it was my feeling that when you say more, I don't know, the more is better, but people who will be affected. And that's the broad group that would be affected. Is it possible that other licensees will be affected? It is my opinion that they shouldn't be. It is my understanding they're not intended to be, and whether they will be or not is something that I think I've been asked to try to get the department to clarify, and I'll talk to the Commissioner of Human Services about.
Representative Dowd.
I guess that's the concern, and I think Representative Advocans even summed up that you know that was the one burning issue that I think everybody has. Can you commit to us today that only the people who are going to be affected by this, let me restate that. Only the people that receive a ballot will be the people that are affected by this?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I didn't write the executive order. I do think that a commitment like that has to come from the folks who will be doing the negotiating, not from myself. I mean, when I was asked to come testify, I said our role here is entirely neutral. And as the deciders of, you know, of what, how the process of the election will go on and who will vote. But in terms of that question as to what they will negotiate over, that's kind of determined by the EO and by the Commissioner of Human Services. And so I don't want to try to answer that question or make a commitment myself on that.
Thank you. Representative Dowd?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. There was one other statement that you made that seemed to be a little confusing to me. You had said that you conduct these elections all the time and it's always 50% plus one of the votes that are returned to you. Is that correct? Are these also elections, and I'm new to this, so forgive me if I'm a little naive to how this works, but you also conduct the elections for the National Labor Relations NLRB? No, you don't.
No, sir.
Okay.
Chair.
Commissioner Tilson.
Representative, no. The NLRB is a separate federal agency that does private sector elections. I won't try to give an explanation about federal sector and you know, state sector labor relations, but there's a whole different structure for the private sector labor relations nationally and a separate structure for state, and there's some constitutional reasons for that, and we can...
But you are...
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. You're conducting the elections where you're actually... having to verify these cards that people sign that requesting an election?
Commissioner,
what is that done under?
Well, let me explain. as was explained earlier, BMS administers two different laws, the Minnesota Public Employment Labor Relations Act, PELRA. PELRA requires a 30% showing of interest to get an election to get a union in. It requires a 30% showing of interest to get an election to get a union out, that is, to certify or decertify. That's the law. The Minnesota Labor Relations Act, which is the private sector law here, has a requirement, has no such requirement in it. And while we usually do require that, we don't always. And under the National Labor Relations Act, there are certain kinds of elections that can be called for without cards. They also normally, it's not a statutory requirement, but they almost always require authorization cards to call for an election. But there are circumstances where there can be an election without cards being shown. And here, the request for an election came directly to the governor, and there was no requirement for showing of cards. And I was directed by the governor to conduct an election under these conditions, and that's what we're doing.
Representative Dowd?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Commissioner. So I guess to clarify, in the instances where you are doing the verifying the 30% of people have indicated that they want to have the election, this is 30% of all of the people eligible, right? You're not doing 30% of the people who were asked.
That's right.
Commissioner Tilson.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative, that's right.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, why is it different then? Because everybody who is asked will be affected by this. And frankly, I'm a little confused as to why potentially more people will be affected, even if they aren't asked if they want to be part of this. Why are we not requiring that same standard that's used with them indicating on a card that they want to be part of a union? Why are we not using that and requiring 50% plus one of everybody who's eligible?
Commissioner Tilson.
Because the executive order provided for an election. I'm using the same procedures for elections that I always use. I'm not aware of a labor relations election that requires more than 50% plus one of those who cast ballots. I've never done it that way.
But you do require, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you. If in order for people to indicate that they want an election, usually, and I know you said this is an abnormal situation, you do require that 30% plus one of all the people sign the card, not 30% plus one of everybody who was asked.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Jones.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
We have several more members that have questions, and I would ask members to keep these very brief, and if you can have your question answered from the questions that the commissioner has provided, that would be helpful. We do need to let the commissioner get out of here and have other people come up and testify. So with that, Representative Anderson, Diane.
Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner, on the executive order by the governor, on item number 3, it says if a majority of licensed, registered, subsidized family child care providers voting in the mail, blah, 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 vote affirmatively for executive meet and greet, that you're going to, the BMS is going to certify the organization so designated. What is your intention as to who you're certifying is to be unionized then? What is your certification going to say only the subsidized daycare providers are part of the union? Or what does Shell certify the organization? What's the organization going to be designated as?
Commissioner Tilson.
Well, you asked, Mr. Chairman, Representative, you asked a really good question. And the answer, I think, when I write a certification of an election, it says, I hereby certify the following results of the election conducted, and it tells exactly what the tabulation of the votes are, and it also indicates the group that was certified. The executive order says that they are certified to meet and confer with respect to licensed, registered, subsidized family child care providers, and I suspect that's what it'll say in the certification. I don't know what else. I thought about it, but
so, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Anderson,
your intention is that this union is only going to be applying to the subsidized family daycare providers.
I think
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think that's the intention of the of the executive order. That's why I say the confusion, because it doesn't say otherwise. The EXIO doesn't say otherwise, and that's, I think, what gave rise to some of this confusion and some of these questions. But I think that was the intent of the EO, even though it doesn't say so. And so that's why I think it's important that the administration, probably through the Department of Human Services, you know, could probably should probably, I'm going to talk to them, ask them if they'll maybe send a letter explaining that how they would handle this if there were such a certification. It's a reasonable question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anderson, Sarah. Thank you, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Tilson. I think I'm still kind of going back and scratching my head, and I think you've done a good job of trying to explain how you're coming to grips with conducting this. But in looking at and asking questions about the different types of organizing elections that are held, if you fall under the NLRB, which is for private sector employees, correct, there's a certain process that's followed. If you would fall under PELRA law, there's a process that's followed. But it just sounds, from my listening to this, and if you could confirm for me, that this election is falling outside of really any of those laws. I cannot find where these home daycare providers are covered. They're not public employees, if I listened to Ms. Newman and heard her correctly, and not necessarily private sector employees, because these people are self-employed. So how is it that this is being held? What law is covering this?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loon, and I want to apologize for calling Representative Dowdy.
That's okay. I moved it over.
See, cards in front of me.
Thank you.
I was warned not to be too chatty in my responses, so I'll try not to be too chatty. But this is...
Wait, people get warned about this?
But I think the answer to your question really is that this is, first of all, it's been done, and this has been done by executive order in numerous other states. It's not strictly under labor relations law. We're using some of the aspects of labor relations law. I'm not an attorney. The governor made the decision to issue the EO based on his understanding of the laws that was communicated to him by his legal advisors. And so the EO says what it says. In other states, they did this without statutory authorization under the executive power of the governor. And I understand that it withstood court appeals in some other states. I'm not an expert, and I didn't research that. I was just told that. And so, no, it's not strictly under state labor law. It is true that state labor law provides that a labor dispute under Minnesota Labor Relations Act, a labor dispute may not necessarily involve that the disputants be have an employer-employee relationship. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the things that's true. I'm not an attorney and really don't want to comment on the legality of it. I'm not qualified to do that. I think this is an administrative procedure where there will be meeting and conferring. There will not be negotiating. There will not be a binding collective bargaining agreement. And so the governor is doing it under his executive authority to administer the executive branch agencies. I don't want to be I'm not a legal expert.
Representative Lynn?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tilson. All right, so what I'm hearing you saying is that there really isn't a specific labor law that authorizes or governs it. It's the governor's decision.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my answer speaks for itself. There is some law indication that labor law applies in certain aspects. The Bureau has done elections in the private sector involving folks who are not employers and employees. Okay. But those involve union officer elections. We oversee union officer elections. It's in the MLRA, and we've done that. So we have done non-employer-employee relations. But this is clearly unique. All right.
Thank you.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, could I ask you about number 10 on the order? It talks about involuntary payment of dues, fair share. Now, as a matter of fact, this is... This can be overridden by any subsequent agreement. Is that correct, between any two parties that might negotiate?
Commissioner Tilson.
I don't know. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative, I don't know the answer. I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, in my understanding, the executive order is what governs this situation, okay? I think there'd have to be a different finding or a different decision by the governor.
So,
Representative Crawford.
Thank you. So, any... subsequent negotiations between these two parties, whatever two parties they are, would be bound by this executive order?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as I said, I'm not an attorney and I don't know the answer to that, but it's my understanding that in issuing this executive order, the governor's intention was that there was going to be no mandatory payments of dues under this arrangement.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Representative. Representative Sanders, with what I believe is our final question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, again. Thank you for your answers today and for your help. This is helping. I do have a similar question along some of those lines, but let's say that the licensed registered daycare providers who receive subsidies were unionized, and they have employees. Would a person who's licensed, registered, unionized, and has two employees, would this prevent them, those employees, from organizing?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, hadn't thought about it. I don't see why it would. They're covered under a separate law, and theoretically they could organize. These are however, the jurisdiction would either be probably, for most of these places, they're so small, they're outside the jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Act. The NLRA's jurisdiction, the federal jurisdiction, requires them to be engaged in interstate commerce. And most of these folks probably aren't engaged in interstate commerce, so probably they're in the jurisdiction of the Minnesota Labor Relations Act. But I suppose they could seek representation under the Minnesota Labor Relations Act. I'm not aware that we've ever had such a request.
Seems like that's going around. Mr. Chair, last question here, and to be quick on your time here, what's the typical participation for a statewide mail ballot that are being mailed out? What's the typical participation?
Commissioner Tilson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sanders, I don't have a number to give you, the typical participation, but I do know that we used to always do on-site elections, which were expensive to conduct, time-consuming, and really inconvenient for employers and employees. And we went gradually over the years to mail ballots to where now we don't occasionally we'll do a mail ballot election, usually under certain special circumstances, usually if there are lots of employees who have suspect addresses. We've done, for example, we did a election for the graduate, for a group of union at the University of Minnesota where there were student instructors, and we did it on site because they changed their addresses so often. But we don't usually do that. But the answer is, I know it's great, much higher. Mail ballot is far higher than any on-site election. That's always true. Always was true before when we used to do mixed mail and on-site. We've always gotten, but I can't give any specific numbers. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I really do appreciate you coming in today. Thank you.
Members, any other further questions for the Commissioner? Seeing none, Commissioner, we very much appreciate your indulgence and your answers to all of our questions and your time. Chairman, thank you very much. It was a pleasure having you here.
Yep.
With that, we will go to, if there's anybody here that wants to testify from SEIU, please come down and let us know what we need to know. Seeing nobody heading down this way, members, we do have a packet or a letter in our packets that we got. I don't know when we got it, but we did have a joint letter from Ask Me and SEIU regarding this situation, and I believe everyone has a copy of that. Is there anyone here from Ask Me that would like to come down and answer questions? And I'm asking this because I thought we had a pretty good exchange in Rochester between I guess it was particularly Ask Me at the end, but both Ask Me and SEIU, and there were just a lot of things that we didn't get answers to that they didn't have answers to, that no one knew, and a lot of the answers were, we don't know until we see the executive order. So now we've got the executive order, and I think there are a lot of questions out there that members of this committee, probably on both sides of the aisle, have, and it would be, frankly, I'm a little disappointed that no one from either union is here to answer those questions after we had the conversations in Rochester, and they indicated a number of times that these were questions that they'd be happy to answer, or at least willing to answer, after we had the executive order. And I know we have the letter, but it would have been nice to have people here in person for that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
To that point, when you threaten people with lawsuits, that's what happens. Well, I was very pleased to see that the commissioner was willing to come and visit with us. But generally, when people threaten to sue my clients, I tell them not to talk to the other side. You've made this, or Senator Han has made this, a very adversarial situation at this point with the threat of a lawsuit. So as a result, you end up with a chilling effect relative to the exchange, and instead get written responses. That's what Senator Han invited, rather than an ongoing exchange by threatening a lawsuit. So if that's how he wants to do business, I guess we'll leave that to Senator Han. But I certainly don't fault the union folks for not wanting to come here and in the threat of litigation and have everything that they say try to be cross-examined by folks. I'm not suggesting that your members would do that, but that would certainly be the sort of concern that they might have when Senator Han almost every day seems to threaten a lawsuit. That's coming from a lawyer. Earlier I applauded that because it's, unemployment is 6.4% now. He's going to bring that down among lawyers anyway. But it certainly doesn't seem to help the process a whole lot, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Atkins, I am disappointed that the unions didn't show, because I haven't ever sued anybody, and I would certainly not threaten the unions. And I thought we had a pretty good exchange in Rochester, and I didn't get anybody's promise, but we had a lot of comments about, well, we'll answer that once we have the executive order. And nobody in this committee, to my knowledge, from either side, was part of any lawsuit. I certainly don't want to have a lawsuit. I just wanted to have some questions answered, and I didn't think that that was unreasonable.
And, Mr. Chairman, I absolutely agree. You've always been very, very good to work with. You never threaten any lawsuit, but our counterparts in the Senate, for good or ill, we get thrown in the same pot with them. And so I just wanted to make sure that the folks from SEIU and AFSCME, who gave every indication that they'd be happy to visit further, that was prior to Senator Han saying what he said in the media about suing over all this. And it's really unfortunate, because I think this could have been a very helpful setting in which to have some further discussions, and I applaud you for your willingness to do that.
Well, thank you, Representative Atkins, and I agree. I think the Commerce Committee is the place, from both sides of the aisle, for people to ask these kind of questions. And I hope these questions get answered for the child care providers and the people that are using their services right now before the election starts. Hopefully we can get the questions answered to everybody's satisfaction. With that, we will move to next on our list, and we do want to be out of here by noon, but first Representative Atkins has a question, or Representative Anderson has a question, and then we'll go to Katie Chase, the Executive Director of MLFCCA. Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, will we have an opportunity, since the union didn't show up, to answer some of these questions? And I think they're very key for us to understand what the answers are to these questions. Are we going to have a chance to maybe ask Ms. Naumann about this after the next group comes up, to maybe she can help shed some light on some of these issues? I don't know if that's within her purview, but...
Well, we can certainly ask her questions. She has always provided good answers to everything in the past. And I will talk to both Ask Me and SEIU and see if we can get them to come. I promise I won't sue. No disrespect to your attention or your profession, Representative Atkins, but I just seriously just want some answers to this. This is, as the Commissioner very eloquently stated a number of times, we're in uncharted waters here. This has never been done, at least not this way, in the state of Minnesota, and I think it's legitimate for this committee to ask these questions.
I'll wait.
Okay. With that, and members, if we do have questions for this testifier or for Ms. Naumann, please feel free to ask them. And with that, we'll turn it over to Ms. Chase. If you could identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
I'm Katie Chase, Executive Director of Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. Mr. Chair and committee members, MLFCCA is the state affiliate to the National Association for Family Child Care. We have county association memberships as well as individual memberships equaling 5,000 providers and advocates in Minnesota. Thank you for your time spent considering the opposing positions on family child care unionization. Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association recognizes and appreciates the following language in the recent executive order. Nothing in this order shall be construed to interfere with parental rights to select and deselect family child care providers or the ability of family child care providers to establish the rates they charge to parents. Nothing in this order shall be construed to require participation or the involuntary payment of dues by any family child care provider. Nothing in this order shall be construed to interfere with the right or obligation of any state agency to communicate or meet with any citizen or organization concerning family child care legislation, regulation, or policy. However, MLFCCA urges Governor Dayton to retract and revise Executive Order 1131 to allow a fair democratic vote of all Minnesota licensed family care providers. All licensed providers will be affected by this outcome and should be heard. MLFCCA's position remains neutral. MLFCCA will support a full majority vote outcome, not a ballot returned vote of the over 11,000 licensed family child care providers in Minnesota. A fair vote of a true majority will resolve this issue. The executive order as written is not a fair majority vote, and it will not resolve this issue. The MLFCCA board has listened to its members both for and against unionization of family child care and have spent years debating and studying the issue. The reasoning for the determination of our current position is as follows. Number one, as language in the order requires unions to be involved in quality improvement initiatives, all providers will be affected by unionization and therefore should have a right to vote. Number two, in a democratic system, all Minnesota licensed family child care workers have a right to vote. Number three, MLFCCA has a responsibility to advocate for all family child care providers in Minnesota, whether or not they have children on child care assistance. Our mission is to support the highest standard of care for children in Minnesota's diverse licensed family child care. We do that through advocacy, education, and recognition. Number four, while MLFCCA regularly advocates to raise CCAP rates, child care assistance rates, this is a subsidy for families, not providers, and does not govern fees charged by providers, nor does it govern their income. Number five, all providers who are willing to take children on CCAP, child care assistance, are not being allowed to vote. This is important. Many have registered their willingness to accept children on CCAP with the Child Care Resource and Referral Agency surveys, but as no family has recently enrolled in CCAP, they have had no reason to register with CCAP. Over 4,000 children are currently on a CCAP waiting list. Therefore, many providers who do not currently have children on CCAP will not be allowed to vote. Six, only a third of Minnesota's licensed family child care providers will have a chance to vote. Seven, MOFCCA is fielding many angry calls and emails from providers who will not be allowed to vote. MOFCCA has forwarded multiple testimonies of deceptive organizing practices to union representatives as they have occurred, and later to Governor Dayton, including multiple reports of impersonating a food program monitor in order to gain access to a home. This has made it clear that providers have not received the factual information they need to help them in their decision. As requested, we will continue to send these reports. This week alone, we have had four calls from four separate individuals that have been told they will not be able to collect any type of subsidy if they do not vote for and join the unions, and that the USDA food program will be in jeopardy if they do not vote for and join a union. In a meeting with Governor Dayton, he intimated that this order was starting small and that there was intent for a potential expansion. So again, MLFCCA respectfully urges Governor Dayton to retract and revise Executive Order 1131 to allow all licensed family child care a vote. We will support the majority outcome of licensed providers in Minnesota. We thank you for your work in this difficult process.
Thank you, Ms. Chase. Members, any questions? Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Chase. I appreciate your testimony. I just want to key in on a point that you raise in terms of fielding questions or concerns from some of your members, and one about impersonating food inspectors to gain access.
That's correct.
Did I hear you correctly? Do you know, under this process, if that happened to them, what do they do with that complaint? Where do they go to register that concern? And which agency has governance over that?
Ms. Chase.
I told them to report it to the union representatives, to the employers, supervisors of the representative that was impersonating food program providers. I also forwarded the information there. I collected written testimonies, which I gave to the union representatives. I meet regularly with union representatives as well, trying to fix this problem from the beginning of its occurrence, which was years ago this was happening. And unfortunately, it didn't really go anywhere. So later we started sending them to Governor Dayton, as he's requested me to continue to do so. And at one point, I did have providers call 911 when they felt intimidated on a regular basis. I did get calls like that as well. So I don't know. You know, that's a good question. I'd like to know the answer to where do they go when they feel intimidated? I say you call 911. I don't know what else to do.
Representative Loon.
Thank you. Well, it sounds like good advice. I perhaps Ms. Newman would have a response to this. It's my understanding that under a union organizing effort that falls under the National Labor Relations Act, if an employee feels intimidated by this effort to collect signatures and that, there is a process for them to go to National Labor Relations Board or something and file a complaint. And under this process, which has been described as unique and without precedence and doesn't appear to have a specific labor law that governs this process, do you know where someone would go?
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, there is language in state law about anti-coercion. However, on the issue of impersonating a food service worker or whatever, I know that the Department of Human Services has fairly stringent fraud language, and I would suggest that might be a point of contact as well, or the county child care resource and referral entities that already exist would be a good reference point for registering some of those complaints and some of those issues, because the food program is part of the child care assistance program that works with the federal government and the Department of Agriculture, but that would be, I think, a very good place to start with the DHS and the county child care contacts.
Representative Luna, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. And I would just say, Ms. Chelsea, it's probably good advice. I applaud your effort to try to help your association members deal with this, but it sounds like perhaps if you're talking to the union and maybe some of the folks who are affiliated with them or purporting to be affiliated with them doing this, they may not get it resolved. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chase. Seeing no further questions, we'll bring up Ms. Parrish. Ms. Parrish, we've seen a lot of things over the years and ways to elicit sympathy from the committee, but
I know.
You've gone above and beyond.
A-plus for effort today. Okay.
If you could, whenever you're ready, please identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Parrish, and I am a licensed family child care provider from Rochester, Minnesota, and I've been an active part of a coalition of providers from across the state who have kind of joined together to inform other providers about what's taking place with this union issue. I am opposed to the unionization of child care, and I was present at the hearing in Rochester, but I didn't speak, only to answer a brief question. Myself and some other of my colleagues also formed the website childcareunioninfo.com to help educate providers about what was taking place, and it's been kind of a source for providers to be able to email us with their concerns and share their stories about how they were also misled by union organizers, so we have some information on that. I was also present at the meeting with Governor Dayton on November 10th, where we were supposed to be sharing our concerns about the unionization effort and concerns about a potential vote. Unfortunately, by the time that we had got there, it appeared that the governor had already made up his mind. So we kind of spent most of our time talking about why we were concerned about this type of a vote that would only involve a minority of the providers. One of the things I wanted to clear up was that the hearing that was held in Rochester, one of my colleagues, Jackie Harrington, had testified about the votes in other states, and we were concerned about how many of the providers in the other states did not get ballots. And the union challenged, our SEIU representatives had challenged our facts and wanted us to cite our sources, and unfortunately we didn't have that information with, but we provided each of you with these little pie charts along with all the sources for that, so that you can see that our information was accurate. And that was one of our concerns, and clearly it was a valid concern because that's exactly what's happening here. Some of the other concerns, I also wanted to clear up, I've heard a couple of times mentioned that providers were asking for the election. Providers who were opposed were asking for the election. I do want to clear that up. We have always said that we don't believe that there should be an election. As independent business owners, this vote should not be taking place. However, if the governor was going to order an election, we asked for a few things. We asked that he place us under the jurisdiction of a labor board so that when they do come and impersonate the food program officials or threaten to allow us to no longer take families on the assistance program, that we have a place to file complaints and there's some recourse there, and so that we would also have an opportunity to decertify in the future. That's why we had asked for the Bureau of Mediation Services, because as we were calling around with these complaints and nobody would take them, it seemed that the Bureau of Mediation Services was the closest thing that we could find to be placed under. The language in the executive order specifically states that these unions, should they be certified as the exclusive representative of the providers who are licensed, registered, and subsidized, that they will be able to negotiate on issues such as quality improvement initiatives, quality standards, quality rating, monitoring and evaluating of family child care providers. These issues go far beyond the scope of the subsidy program, and they will affect all 11,000 licensed family child care providers. We did share that information with the governor on the 10th. Let's see here. This is not a fair vote. We also have deep concerns about the way this decision was made and how quickly it's being pushed through. In the beginning of October, the union started a new push going door to door, and they somehow knew that they only needed to visit the providers in the subsidy program. They sent out surveys only to those providers on the subsidy program and asked the providers to sign pledge cards to vote yes in an election that had not been ordered yet. How did the unions know that first week in October that the vote would happen and would only involve those on the subsidy program when the rest of the state didn't find out until November? Regardless of how they found out, this gave them over a month to single out which providers would be voting yes so that they could ensure that those ballots got turned in. We have heard from providers through our website and who have contacted us who are opposed, who are being, again, intentionally misled by organizers. One, after telling the organizer that she was opposed, was told to make sure to send in her ballot on January 2nd, the election day. Of course, we all know the election will be done by then. Of course, others have been told that the union will not affect them unless they send in a ballot. These are some of the more the same unethical tactics that we saw in the collection of the signatures on the authorization cards that we were so concerned about. These unions are not supported by family child care providers. The majority of family child care providers are opposed to this, and the only way that the union can win these elections is if voter turnout is very low, which was one of our concerns in the votes that had happened in other states. They're notoriously underpublicized. I don't know of any notices that have gone out. Daily we're getting emails from providers asking, do I get to vote? How will I find out if I get to vote? I know Mr. Tilson had said that if they don't get a ballot, if they're eligible to vote and they don't get a ballot, they can call a 1-800 number, but providers don't know if they're eligible to vote. So how do they know to call that number? We've been trying to, he also said the list was public, we've been trying for days now to get a list of those providers, and we've been told that DHS will be releasing a statement. We still haven't gotten it yet, so we have not been able to obtain that list yet. The union somehow had that list in early October, and we still cannot get a hold of it. So I don't know how this can be, how providers are supposed to find out whether or not they're eligible to vote. Something else I wanted to discuss was, let's see here, number 10, nothing in this order shall be construed to require participation or the involuntary payment of dues by any family child care provider. This was a big concern when we read this, because the governor sent us a letter saying this means nobody will ever have to pay fair share dues. We, of course, immediately contacted legal counsel to ask them about this, because the unions have maintained all along that dues are only for members, that what the rest of the people are charged are called agency fees, fair share fees, representation fees, but they're not dues. Dues are only for members. So the fact that fair share fees were not specifically addressed concerned us. And the fact that it doesn't technically say that they're prohibited. It says that this order cannot be construed to require. And one of the things that they've done in other states is the registration forms that you have to fill out to accept those CCAP payments. They have like a box that you check or something that you have to fill out that says that you agree to the deduction of either dues or fees. And if you don't fill that out, your registration is not complete. So if they do something like that here, anybody who takes CCAP has to agree for the registration to be complete, and therefore they're not involuntary anymore. You're agreeing to it. So that language absolutely does not prohibit fair share fees, and it's something that both unions have said that they intend to collect. So I have concerns about that. And I think that's about all I've got. So.
Well, thank you. And we've got a couple of questions for you, okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parrish. I've read in Washington State what happens if you are not a member of the union, that your public subsidy rate is, I think it's about 2% lower than if you were a union member. Is that a fear that you have as a daycare provider, that if you don't join the union that you're going to be penalized and not get the same subsidy rate as those that do?
Absolutely, and there's a lot of ways that they could negotiate things in the contract that would make it so that you're really going to lose out if you don't join. So it would, you know, while they're not requiring participation, there's language that could be written in the contract or it says in here somewhere that all the policies will be written out. So I have reason to believe that there will be a contract, whether it's a collective bargaining agreement or not. But any contract that they reach with DHS can have language that, that could push providers to almost have to be a part of this. And the other thing I wanted to address too, if I could, is the whole when we hear people say that it's voluntary, I find that incredibly misleading. When providers are looking to make a decision, they need to understand how this is going to impact them. They can't do that if they're getting letters from AFSCME that were written by Governor Dayton's office, the frequently asked questions that were written by Governor Dayton's office. AFSCME just sent them out to providers, and it says that it's voluntary. Membership is voluntary. Representation is not, and providers have the right to know that. They are not being told that. So as I sit here and I listen to voluntary, 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 it breaks my heart because providers have that right to know that they will be represented by this union, by these unions, should they have the majority of ballots if they have a child on the CCAP program.
Thank you, Ms. Parrish. Representative Anderson, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Parrish, too. So what is your recourse if you have to pay fair share dues or if you join the union? What will you do? Will you increase your rates to the parents to pay to care for the children, or what will you do? I mean, what's the response, do you think, for the average Joe daycare provider?
Absolutely. You know, anytime costs go up, those costs are passed along to child care, or to the parents. We don't have a huge bottom line to where we can absorb a lot of extra costs. And, you know, I've always said that some of the things that the union has talked about doing, mandatory preschool programs, mandatory participation in QRIS, reducing the number of children we can take, these are things that they've said to providers across the state. They don't say them publicly very much, but those could have a much higher impact on costs than the union dues or fair share fees would. So the fair share fees are a concern, but they're not the biggest concern. Some of the things that they could negotiate or change could have a much higher impact on costs.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Parrish. I'd like to ask Ms. Newman about Ms. Parrish's number 10 on fair share and kind of take a stab at the question I asked the commissioner earlier. In your experience, does anything in the written executive order, is that able to be overwritten by future negotiations by the parties that may be involved in it, whether it's a union or not?
Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Crawford, a couple of things on that. First, the fair share fee is a term that is used and defined in PELRA, which is the one is 179A. So 179, the Minnesota Labor Relations Act, is silent on fair share. PELRA has the specific authorization on fair share. So that's number one. Number two, the legislature always has the authority to come in and put into statute any authorization or specific prohibition that it desires. So clearly, as a legislature, you can come in and put into statute whatever you want on that particular issue.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How about my point is the governor's executive order, though. Is that able to be superseded by a union vote?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the legal authority of the executive orders, I'm not the one to answer that. There are, Mr. Shepherd in our office is much better qualified to speak to that. I can't answer that for you. I'm sorry.
Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, other questions for Ms. Parrish?
To that,
Representative Atkins.
To that point, and if Ms. Parrish wants to weigh in, I very much appreciate, I think everybody does, hearing what the concerns are. And Representative Crawford noted a great point, which is that the executive order, as I understand it, simply calls for the vote. And then we've had some discussion, good discussion, I think, about how the logistics of that are going to work. I've still, thus far, only heard the one substantive concern, and frankly, it was primarily focused on by me and a couple others, but the over the number of people voting and what a group the group that will be impacted by that. The point, though, that I think Representative Crawford made very well is that once the vote occurs, there's still 100% authority in this body to pass whatever prohibitions or expansions, I guess, if that's what people wanted to do, relative to that vote. And so I think it's important, and I appreciate the chair holding the hearing, but just so we're clear, all we're doing is having the vote at this point, and then it's a matter of the that doesn't take any rights or responsibilities away from this body to pass whatever further prohibitions or changes that we might desire to make to that particular animal or whatever we, I don't know exactly how to describe this because Ms. Newman pointed out it's not something that we've really done before and Commissioner Tilson said the same thing, but it's a scenario that we still have authority over once we come back into session in January.
Representative Davids.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the Atkins comments, we may have the authority, but to be able to get our bill signed into law, the chances are zero to none. So we may have the authority, but we can't follow through. And actually, I think the concern is a runaway union here is the way it looks to me, and that we really don't have a whole lot to say as long as my good friend Governor Dayton's in the corner office, because we can pass all we want, and you know very well it's not going to be signed into law.
Mr. Chair, to that point,
Representative Atkins.
And to my good friend Representative Davids, Chair Davids, you proposed not long ago a huge deal that would raise property taxes. Governor Dayton didn't like it, but he still signed it. And this is the kind of thing, in fact, people are feeling that impact right now, Chairman Davids, with huge property tax increases. The Governor Dayton nonetheless signed it because that was the only way that was going to get us out of here past the shutdown. With respect to this particular issue, however, Governor Dayton actually listened to the testimony, as far as we can tell, from Rochester, where the folks said, we don't object to a union, we just want to make sure it's voluntary, people should be able to have a voice in it. That's exactly what the executive order reflected. So when you say it's zero to none, I'd suggest it's 100% so far. Governor Dayton took what the testimony was and put it forward in that fashion. My hope would be that he would continue to work with us, just as Commissioner Tilson has in coming here today, to try to carry this out in a way that makes the best sense.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the Dayton property tax increases.
Did you say the Davids property tax?
No, the Dayton. I think he signed the bill into law.
I thought it was Davids property tax.
We have to work through the chair. I'm having enough trouble keeping track of whose turn it is.
We're all chairs.
Representative Davids.
The issue of the property tax increases that Governor Dayton signed into law, to his defense, that's, last I looked, legislatures don't vote for the property taxes for school districts, townships, cities, and counties. So if we have a discussion there, that's fine. Also, the former chair of the tax committee, I believe, had a bill, House File 398, that eliminated local government aids, CPAs, and market value homestead credit. So at least I was able, and the Governor Dayton, we were able to save the LGAs and the CPAs. And it'll be up to the cities, counties, townships, and so forth to levy what they'd like to. So if we don't have a property tax discussion, I'm ready.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm so used to being on the tax committee in this room, so it kind of lends itself to that discussion. Thank you, though, to Chair Davids.
And seeing no further questions from Ms. Parrish, we are almost out of time, and I apologize. We're not going to get to everybody, but we'll have Christina Randall, if you're still here, please come on down. And
Christina?
Ms. Parrish, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming in, appreciate your testimony. And I'm not seeing Christina coming down. How about Dinah Spurgeon? Another provider, please come up and tell us what we need to know. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Dinah Spurgeon. I'm a licensed child care provider from Nicollet County, Minnesota. I closed my business to be here for today. I inconvenienced five families, and if any of you have small children, you know how inconvenient that is to close at the last minute. I inconvenienced five families to be here. I'm losing a day's wages to be here. That's how important I feel this is to me. The vote to unionize licensed child care providers is not fair to me. Currently, I don't have any children enrolled who are eligible for child care subsidies. Therefore, I am one of over half the licensed child care providers in Minnesota who do not get a vote. But the union seat at the table to discuss with DHS things like licensing regulations, rating systems, trainings, payments, rates, and etc. will in turn affect the same rules that govern my private business. Please, I'm asking you to give me a vote in this matter. If I should have a grievance with the unions, like we've discussed here, I've heard discussed here, whom will I go to? One of the families that I currently have as a client told me that they are very much opposed to the unionization of child care providers. They do not see how a union could ensure better care for their children. In fact, they feel that if such unionization would take place, I, their provider, would have a lot more red tape to wade through, and that way it might take me away from the care of their children. They also were adamant that such unionization would ultimately cause them to pay more for child care services because, one, the monies for these raised subsidy payments, which the unions have promised, would probably come from their tax money. And two, I may have to raise my rates to stay comparable to state subsidy payments and to pay for some of these things that the unions... What I'm getting at is the quality rating system. I would have to upgrade a lot of things in my home to meet their standards, and this would come from my parents. The monies would come from my parents. I am not for union intervention in my private business. I would not be here today if I didn't have to be here today, but we have to be here because this is a very important issue. So what I'm simply asking for is a fair vote. Place this ballot in the hands of all 11,000 licensed family child care providers in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spurgeon. Members, any Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Spurgeon, I really appreciate you coming down today. I'm a mom of, my son is in daycare today, and I appreciate the work that you do. It certainly takes a certain special person to do that on a day-to-day basis, and it's wonderful that you provide that service to families across the state of Minnesota. My concern, I know in greater Minnesota from girlfriends that I have that are looking for daycare, that it isn't always the easiest to find. There aren't as many people providing this service, especially given the requirements for licensing that is required of you on a very limited budget that you're working with. Mm-hmm. And I'm just concerned, I'm wondering if you can tell me, you know, if this something like this goes through, you don't have the chance to vote on it, how this might impact access in your eyes to daycare in greater Minnesota in particular, and if you can comment on that.
Ms. Spurgeon.
I feel like I have to be careful about what I say, but I know I've heard from some providers who will simply close their doors. They will no longer be doing this job if it comes to the unionization. So then you're limiting the field even more to those providers that are open. I don't see that this would open up any more child care providers, any more opportunities for the home-based daycares. What I'm afraid is going to happen is that the home-based daycares are being shoved out, and the unions and other people are trying to get us to form big institutionalized daycare centers to herd all of our children through. That's what I'm afraid this is really after.
Thank you. And members, we're just about out of time here. We're going to have one more person come down on the list of people that notified us they wanted to testify. Well, Cindy Cunningham, if you're here, if you could come down. And a good point, if there's anyone else here that took a day off of work or traveled a great distance and wants to come down and speak, we would certainly make you welcome. With that, Ms. Cunningham, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you. I will try to keep this brief and not cover things that other people have already covered. Good morning, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the time here. I traveled all of a mile and a half to 2 miles. I live straight north of the Capitol. But I did.
Was it icy? Did you have to walk? Was it all uphill?
No, actually, I thought downhill. But I did have to close my business. I did inconvenience about 7 families. I put 2 children on the bus this morning, and then I closed. I am a part of the coalition of providers that Jennifer has referred to in the Child Care Union. I personally have invested a large amount of money and time and effort in this. One of the biggest pieces that's wrong in this process is just that we're even here talking about it. The burden of the education and understanding and the dissemination of information has been put on us as providers. I know much too much about labor law. I already knew quite a bit about legislative process. But labor law is all new to me, and I fully respect, I'm going totally off of my piece, I fully respect unions. We've been accused of being anti-union. The problem I have in this, on that particular word, is that anyone else who is a part of a union has some kind of protection and process. When we met, and I was one of the people who met first with Governor Dayton's office staff, he did not meet with us until he had received the letter on November 8th. He did not meet with us until November 10th. He refused, made himself inconvenient, whatever. Did not give us the time and effort to do that until his decision had been made. When people hear the word union, every single person in here who has had to figure this out, every person provider, every person on the street has had to say, what? What is this kind of a union? To me, it becomes, there are nonprofits established by AFSCME, which is CCPT, Child Care Providers Together, SEIU's nonprofits, it is Kids First, I believe. I'm under AFSCME, so I know more about that, or would be. It is unionizing those nonprofits. That this has happened in 15 other states does not make it right. There are a number of providers. I personally, in May, sent out a mailing to the 650 providers here in Ramsey County. I joked, but I said I didn't want to be the last one standing when the governor signed it and know that I knew. So I have gone, that bottom line profit of mine has gone out the window over the last few months because it is not right that providers are having to come up with this information and give the information out. Consequently, Ramsey County providers are fairly well understood, are getting it, and are very much against it. The information has only been primarily from the unions, unless our coalition or other individual providers have been able to get that information out. And in all due respect, this is our businesses, this is our livelihood. That there is political banter that it's going back on, as much as I understand it and respect it, angers me. This is our livelihood. It is a matter of my income. It is a matter of, I'm a single mom. I've been having to go against union organizers. If you want to check where that happened, one place where that happened, Friday night I had the privilege, I would put it, to be on the Almanac against Carol Nieder, I'm sorry, I believe. She is the executive director of SEIU. That's who they decided was the appropriate person to debate against me in the Almanac. The reality is she was very angry. She was very upset. She was very attacking of me. She actually lied or misconstrued information on public television, of which I have documentation to say was wrong. She was wrong in what she said. I have the documentation to say that she is wrong. And yet she looks at me as if I don't know what I'm talking about. Our group is extremely, extremely well-organized, as best as we can be for grassroots, and very well educated as far as this. When we asked Governor Dayton's office for BMS, trust me, the only thing I know about BMS is labor law. When I asked for that, that's what we were asking for, that these unions can go through and have no recourse. We have no one to go talk to. When we did meet with Governor Dayton, we asked him that question, who do we go to? He said him. I don't think he's a union supervisor. I don't think he has any authority. I don't think he's on BMS, the NLRB. I don't know any authority that he has where he's going to control what they do. That providers don't yet have the information. The union organizers have sent out or gone door to door in here in November and September or October, and talked, but only to people that they already knew were interested. They sent out a survey, and when I called Adrian Kern, who is the lead organizer, and I said, what am I supposed to do with it? She knows me by face now. And she said, well, just rip it up and throw it away. That's what I was supposed to do with my survey. And my question was, why are you even doing a survey when this is being contested? Well, we're moving forward because we expect it to be done. This was last month. I did just receive a letter that was referred to from Adrian Kern that just said, this is what Governor Dayton says about the union and the FAQs. Much of the FAQs are flawed, are questionable. Some of them are inaccurate, from my opinion. And my name was wrong on the envelope. And many providers have raised to me, how are we going to ensure that we even know? We've been told September 30th, excuse me, Commissioner Tilson, said October 15th. We have not been publicly even told who gets to vote. The whole title that's put out there, if I can even begin to say it, is Licensed Registered Subsidized Family Child Care Providers, does not exist in our business. There is not one provider who knows who that is. From an automatic piece. It's not a subgroup of our licenses. To get it from DHS, we've been trying all week to get a listing from DHS of who these providers will be. They either won't talk to us, have told us that it'll cost us money, of which we have none, or we can't get a hold of the right people to even get the list. And then we have to figure out how are we going to even be able to contact these providers. Most providers get information from the unions. If they're against it, they rip it up and throw it away as they've been advised. They do not believe that it can even happen here, and I appreciate the time. Personally, what I am asking for is that somehow, the reason the unions aren't here, from my best understanding, they got what they wanted. They haven't talked to the legislators because they were going to Governor Dayton to get the executive order. They've got it. They have no reason to be talking to you, and I apologize for that because I think that's wrong. I think they should be. I think the vote should be at best delayed. When we say we would like a vote, all we're saying is give us an option to do this with money, with resources, with town hall meetings, with some kind of an educational process for providers instead of Jennifer, myself, and our coalition being the ones on the ground trying to run our businesses and get this out to the 4,300 or 11,000 providers. All of our associations and agencies, the majority, have taken a neutral stance. Part of that has been from the pressure of the unions that they're not supposed to speak against the unionization, so everybody stays neutral. I personally have been trying to get agencies to look and say, that doesn't mean quiet. You need to speak up. You need to give both pieces of information. That has only recently been happening. So a vote is questionable. I personally do not want to vote. We should not be unionized. We should not be turning loose a union without any rules. A personal statement, I will just say, by December 5th, right before the vote, I will be sending my son off to boot camp. He's joining the Marines. And we've had many discussions about the rights and responsibilities as we've gone up through our life. This is not my first venue into trying to be active politically. We've had a lot of discussions about that, and I've had to try to explain to him what an executive order does and how the stroke of a pen, I therefore have no rights. The legislators we've tried to talk to prior to the executive order, we had virtually no response. Nobody could believe this would happen. I am glad you were here today. For whatever reason, 11,000 providers is not the only piece. It's not just who gets to vote. It's a larger picture than that. So my personal plea is stop it. If it's a lawsuit, personally, go for it. I'm tired of this. I want someone to help figure out how to stop and give us back our rights that we have to be able to be self-employed people and not be under the control of the union people. So,
thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you for coming today. I appreciate you taking time away from your business to do this. The question I had, I actually wasn't going to ask it of you. I was going to ask it of the unions. Unfortunately, they're not here today. They apparently can talk on Almanac, but not in front of the Commerce Committee. But I did want to ask if you could help provide a little information on this. So do you have a concern at all that, you know, if this goes into place and you've got the union that's negotiating with the Department of Human Services, that there will be a preferred list of providers that would be generated, that if you as a parent are receiving a subsidy from the state for child care, that you only have a limited providers to go to?
So because, okay, this provider has jumped through hoops X, Y, and Z, therefore you can only take your child to this provider under this kind of new negotiation strategy. Is there any concern that you have that that would ultimately make it so that parents couldn't choose the provider that they wanted to? They'd have to go through a preferred list of providers?
Mrs. Cunningham.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have a whole list of those kinds of concerns. The connection of the quality control rating system being broadened and put out to all providers, the CCAP connection with the quality control, with the grants, with all of those things. It opens up a whole realm of that. One of my biggest concerns also with the CCAP is it is a family benefit. It's not my benefit. And that the unions are working to try to increase and change that on the backs of our businesses, I think is wrong. If that needs to be changed, it needs to be changed through public sector.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just a question that came up. How, when you ask about CCAP and having to jump through additional hoops, and again, I don't have children right now in daycare, they're all adults, but is that's a state program, and we set those requirements for CCAP, and if you wanted to take your child to a daycare provider that didn't qualify, didn't jump through the hoops of the state, you couldn't take them there currently. So how would that's not going to change in the future, is my understanding. So am I correct in that or not?
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I have very limited knowledge about child care programs, but it is my understanding that the child care assistance program is co-administered by the federal and state government because of funding streams, and that Minnesota currently has licensing and regulation that applies broadly to providers. You can be licensed, registered, and unlicensed providers, I believe, are in statute. So that is all language that's in statute, and now you have exhausted my knowledge of child care regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I won't ask my follow-up question.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Members, any other final questions? Or is there any else in the audience that traveled a long way that wants to speak? And I want to be respectful of people's time here. It's 10 after 12, and we told everyone we'd be done by noon. But if there's anyone that did travel a long way that we didn't hear from in either the Senate hearing 6 weeks or so ago or in Rochester, please come on down. If not, anybody? If not, members, thank you all for coming. I know some of you travel a long way. Thank you to everybody in the audience that was here. I appreciate everyone's time and attention, and we are adjourned.